Line, and thanks also to the Municipal Eco Resiliency Project, to Tim Rice, Yolotle X, and Juan Villa de Sola for their interview with Jalila and Leilani of Kasama Farm. The interview is part of MERP's Food Sovereignty Media Series and was made possible by a grant from the Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission. When we post the show, we'll post the complete interview, and please do like it and subscribe. And finally, thanks to Fran Michelle for their segment, What's Cuckoo, and for their technical support behind the scenes. I'm going to play out today's show with more of the MERP-produced song Roots, featuring Wazla, Mike Crenshaw, Tony Hill, and Tolilo.
Drums of war in this field.
The water, the juice, or the booze that you sip. Who you kiss? Holy scripts, the words that we whisper, the jewels that you spit. Think about what you put in your mouth. Does it build you up or is it breaking you down? What about the words that come out? What is meant, the intent of you making a sound? Mama, the porridge that strengthen and nourish. We forge in the forest from birth till we flourish. Put in the time and the earth will provide. We harvest the garden, no one should be starving. Seed to the leaves, to the tree we align. The food that we eat feeds our hearts and our
minds. This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio during this special programming campaign, All Thrills No Frills, Volume 4. Now through April, you'll hear different marathons and series, all brought to you by our fantastic programmers, including specials for Black History Month and International Women's Day. If you'd like to check out our specials, go to kboo.fm/ATN.
Welcome to Lucas Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we start, I want to remind you that KBOO is funded by you, the listener. So please show your support for this amazing community resource during our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 membership drive by making a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community station you're listening to right now. When voters overwhelmingly passed a new city charter in 2022, optimism abounded that the new form of government would more truly represent all of Portland, not just the business elite who had been running things pretty much for over 150 years. The city was supposed to be run by a 12-member city council representing all of Portland's neighborhoods. However, as Portland City Council takes up a resolution seeking to provide oversight over Zenith Energy's land use process, some new power dynamics have emerged over who makes decisions that impact the public. Today we talk again with Street Roots investigative journalist Jeremiah Hayden about this concerning dynamic and what he's uncovered through public document requests that reveal the cozy relationship between members of the city's administrative branch and the Portland Metro Council, formerly the Portland Business Alliance. Jeremiah, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me.
So you put out an article in Street Roots a few weeks ago, and I remember the first thing I remember about it was like every paragraph was only like a sentence long, and it was like sort of bullet points, mental bullet points. So let's talk about what was in that article and what was so kind of earth-shattering about it.
Yeah, I think it probably requires a little bit of a step back to say that the Portland Metro Chamber, which is essentially a lobbying organization for businesses, and you get this kind of it's interchangeable with the name Portland Business Alliance. They've kind of tried to rebrand a little bit due to maybe some reputation issues in the past, and you hear Portland Business Alliance, it sounds like small businesses, coffee shops, things like that. This is massive companies that are a part of that, including the Western States Petroleum Association and like kind of large organizations.
So a lot of them are actually not locally owned businesses. Is that true?
Right. These are some large corporations. I believe like Nike. There's just a lot of like really large global organizations that pull in billions of dollars a year. So it kind of gives this brand of the small business thing, but it really is kind of a very powerful interest group. They lobby the city more than any other organization, city officials, and have over the years just done a lot of work to sort of reduce tax rates on large corporations, push through some things that that really benefit kind of the upper class, locally.
I can think of a couple of things where they lobbied on the other side of climate justice, one being the Portland Clean Energy Fund, which they lobbied heavily against, and a lot of initiatives on the state level, which would have increased regulation relating to climate and other environmental issues.
Right. Yeah. I mean, not to mention that in 2017 they appealed the city's fossil fuel terminal zoning amendments, alongside the Columbia Pacific Building Trades Council and Western States Petroleum Association. There are a lot of there are a number of examples of them actually sort of facially kind of saying, hey, we want to do this new clean energy thing, and then on the other side of it actually kind of operating against divesting from fossil fuels in the city.
They also have a long history, and I have a sense, I kind of imagine these white guys back in 1859 when Oregon became a state, and I guess Portland was already a city at that point for a little bit longer. And they just sort of felt, they'd wiped out all the indigenous people who lived in the area, and they were in charge. And in fact, they weren't allowing anybody but white people into the state of Oregon. It was illegal for blacks to live here. That was part of the deal when Oregon became a state. And that somehow, that legacy has just continued in many ways.
Right. You do see it from, early timber. This is the United States is, colonized, and they've continued to do colonizer things ever since. And so, that's a question when it comes to things like, a bit of what we're talking about today with Zenith Energy and the CEI hub. As we speak, the city council is doing a meeting about what's going on at the CEI hub, and that has, kept indigenous communities from, their waters forever, and negatively impacted the environment and the salmon that tribes depend on. So, yeah, you're right. It does go way back. And I think it's sort of in that context that, bringing back these, getting back these public records that show how the Portland Metro Chamber sent a letter to the city council to say, hey, we really need you to approve Zenith Energy's land use compatibility statement. Advocates, they sent this on January 28th, and it was just 6 days later that the city went ahead and approved this land use statement. So, I'm sure we'll refer to that as the Lux repeatedly for listeners. So that seems to kind of come from, okay, we think that this is a good idea. We are part of this thing called this. This letter is signed by CEO Andrew Hone, and it was sent by John Isaacs to Council President Alana Pertl-Guinney, the mayor, a handful of other people. And it sort of invoked this clean industry initiative, saying the chamber is a formal partner of the city's clean industry initiative to decarbonize Portland's industrial sector. They said, we've committed publicly to lead the effort to meet the city's 2050 industrial carbon emission reduction goals through the Portland Clean Industry Hub. So, and then a lot of kind of things about renewable diesel that I think you probably know more than I do about, but sort of the industry kind of talking points about how renewable energy, renewable diesel is going to be the thing specifically that, you know, really saves the earth from climate catastrophe. Saying it can reduce, this letter says it can reduce it by, carbon emissions by up to 80%. And this is a reason that they need to have this oil by rail company coming through the city of Portland so that it can export all along the West Coast.
By the way, is Zenith part of the Portland Business Alliance?
Zenith is not. There are some closely related, you know, I mean, it's law firm, Stoll Reeves is. That's not to say necessarily that only for Zenith or a lot of organizations that are part of, you know, that Stoll Reeves represents. But yeah, and then the Western States Petroleum Association is as well. So there are some kind of closely related Zenith. Zenith is closely related to the Metro Chamber in some ways. They can get somebody on the phone at least.
So you think that it seems suggestive that this letter that they sent just a few days before there was this deadline that the Department of Environmental Quality had given Zenith to present a new land use compatibility statement. We should probably backtrack a little in case people don't listen to every episode of the show. Mm-hmm. We talked about this last time you were on. But the DEQ, after a hearing in which a lot of people raised issues that they seemed to be unaware of about how much Zenith had violated city ordinances and maybe state laws and whatever. So DEQ did their first surprise visit to Zenith and discovered all these infractions and maybe that basically major violations and withdrew the LUCs that they had received from the city in 2022 and asked them for a new one. And so the deadline was February 3rd or 4th?
4th, yeah.
And on February 3rd, the city granted the LUCs.
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, this is really important context. The reason that that DEQ said that they rescinded the previous LUCs and then said, you need to go to the city and get a new one. We're going to fine you $372,000 because Zenith illegally constructed 250 meters of piping. There's a resolution in front of the city council right now, you know, later this week, this will happen, to investigate this process to see if Zenith potentially violated a franchise agreement. It kind of has wide impacts. A $372,000 fine is no small thing. And so DEQ thought this was pretty egregious. This adds on to another, you know, dozen or more violations that Zenith has had, you know, since it's been here for the past decade. So that's really the only reason that Zenith is front of the city asking for this land use statement again at all. StreetRoot started filing public records requests kind of right after we heard about that. Just to see, there was a bit of a fear from advocates that the city would try to push this through before the end of the year. We had the old form of government at that point, very much like, you don't touch my bureau, I won't touch yours, kind of dynamic with city councilors who could kind of get away with a lot of this stuff. And advocates have called this a backroom deal for the previous land use statement from 2022. And there was a bit of a fear that that was still going to continue to happen through the month of December. Mayor Keith Wilson, to his credit, said that that probably wouldn't be a good idea for the city to do that, knowing that 27 city council candidates had signed a letter saying, please don't make this decision. Leave it to the new council. Portland voted for through ranked choice voting, a much more responsive form of government to the community. And they wanted the community to have that input, something that the state Land Use Board of Appeals actually agrees with. The community should have input. So we started filing these public records requests and started getting some, you know, hundreds to thousands of pages back at once and trying to kind of sift through them and see what was there. Again, this letter, you know, and some of these other text messages is what kind of led to us being able to file some more requests to see kind of how the city's doing business under this new form of government.
And what had you found?
Well, so, I mean, you know, we found, I mean, over the course of that month, we found that Zenith is trying to add what is known as sustainable aviation fuel. They wanted to start blending that at its spot on the Willamette River. That is a big change from what they've been doing in the past.
Let's talk just a moment for what that is, because while renewable diesel can be 100% renewable diesel when you put it in a truck tank, gas tank, that so-called sustainable aviation fuel, I think, can only be a 50-50 blend.
Right. It has to be, it has to include jet fuel in order to get a plane in the air and to get the plane to stay in the air. So what advocates for sustainable aviation fuel like it because it's a drop-in fuel. You don't have to create a whole new system of flying airplanes, you know, like an electric airplane or something.
Or helium. I mean, hydrogen.
Right, exactly. You don't have to create a whole new system for that, new mechanics and stuff. So that sort of can sort of immediately on one flight make a difference on that flight, how much it is actually, it can reduce it by, you know, 25% of the carbon emissions or whatever.
So what is in sustainable aviation fuel?
Oh, well.
Is it like renewable diesel with quotes around it?
I think a lot of, you know, there are a handful of different ways that we probably don't have time to get into here, but there are a handful of different ways that these feedstocks can come, that can be used to create the sustainable aviation fuel. Once this sustainable aviation fuel is made, then it can be transported. This is what Zenith wants to do, is transport it to these tanks on the Willamette River and then add the blending with jet fuel right there on the river. So just still explosive materials. That's important to point out, is that SAF, sustainable aviation fuel, is not, it's not any less explosive. It's not necessarily much better for the environment in the long run. If you include, you know, from the very beginning to the very end of its use, it could potentially be worse. I still think you'd probably know more about this than I do, but I appreciate your questions.
Well, actually, I'm going to put a little plug in right now. If you want to learn more about the so-called sustainable or renewable fuels, there's a group called Rumble on the River that puts on these community panels every month. It's going to be one this Thursday. It's going to be at Chavara Shalom on Northwest 18th, and I believe it's between Johnson and Kearney. I'm not positive because I left all my notes at home. But anyway, it's there. And it'll start at 6:30, and there'll be tabling starting at 5:30. And the panel is going to include, as a matter of fact, Jeremiah.
I will be on that panel.
Yeah, and Dan Sears, who's going to talk about Next Energy, which is this organization, another company from out of state that wants to build one of the world's largest renewable diesel refineries at Port Westward on the Columbia Estuary. A lot of people think very bad idea. Mm-hmm. And person whose name I don't have on the tip of my tongue, but it's Amy, and she's with Stand Up for Family Farms, I think. And she's going to be talking about biogas. And then we're going to show the first 15 minutes of my new film called Chasing Chimeras, The Lure of Deceptive Climate Solutions. And it's a section on renewable diesel. So this would be a great opportunity to learn about what all these so-called renewable fuels are. And so again, is it this Thursday, March 20th at Chavara Shalom on Northwest 18th Street, starting at 6:30. And I want to let you know that you are listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, KBFG LPF and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And this is during our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign, going on now through April. This month, KBOO is celebrating Women's History Month by bringing you a series of special programs throughout the month created by, for, and about women. So check out this special and more at kboo.fm/ATNF4. And today we're talking with Street Roots investigative journalist Jeremiah Hayden about what he's uncovered through public documents requests that reveal the cozy relationship between members of the city's administrative branch and the Portland Metro Council. Let's talk about, was maybe the last time I saw you, actually, you were busily typing away at a hearing where at City Council where they were about to appoint Michael Jordan to be the city administrator, still interim city administrator for another year. This was very contentious because this was like the day after Michael Jordan had said that we should go ahead and give the Lux to Zenith. So there were the City Council chambers was full of people who were opposed to this. So let's talk a little bit about what happened that day and how that is kind of foreboding of what might be going on behind the scenes in the city government.
Yeah, this new form of government, you know, Portland voters passed this broadly to introduce ranked choice voting. You know, three different council members from four different districts around town. This is really the first time that people in District 1, kind of farther out, Southeast Portland, have had real representation at City Hall. Joanne Hardesty was the only other city councilor who's ever been from East Portland. It also, at the exact same time, it changed the charter. So, like, the whole way that the city does its business changed at the exact same time. And so those 12 city council members, I like to think of them as the state legislature, I think is the easiest way to kind of generally get the idea. And they're meant to legislate. And then you have the administrative branch that's meant to, you know, do the day-to-day business. That's what Michael Jordan's job is to make sure that when the city council passes a thing, it goes, you know, back to this administrative branch that basically, like, does that work. Michael Jordan was appointed by Ted Wheeler in July of the prior year, in 2024, to basically assist with this transition. You might remember that Ted Wheeler took over all of the bureaus in mid-July. And part of the purpose of that, I think, was to start to kind of foreshadow a little bit and make a little bit more clarity on how the new form of government would operate once it was all intact and once everybody was sworn in. It's worth mentioning there are still a lot of holes in how this city works. So people might tune into a city council session and think these people don't even know what they're doing. Sometimes I've heard this critique from people. Well, part of that is because there's actually not really a pathway for that specific thing for the city councilors to actually do, to do that work. So they're actually building the city code out as we speak. Lots of cleaning up to do.
Actually, I'm kind of thinking that it seems like a lot of the problems that this current city council was facing are roadblocks that the old city council put in place before they left.
Yes, there was a real effort. I mean, you know, bringing it back to the Portland Metro Chamber, they challenged in 2022, they legally challenged a proposal for the Charter Commission for this new form of government. So there is, you know, it's worth sort of elucidating this, you know, fact that some interests in town built a lot of power under the previous form of government and are very resistant to the changes that are meant to give the power back to the people. And so I don't want to get into what, you know, Michael Jordan's you know, moves are. I think he's a, you know, I've heard him to be a very stable force, you know, in the government, who listens to people, who really is, you know, actively trying to, you know, do the next best thing for the city. He works for the mayor, and then he appoints six deputy city administrators for these distinct sort of service areas, right? And the one that was really working a lot on the Zenith stuff is Donnie Oliveira, the deputy city administrator for the community and economic development service area.
And he used to be with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability.
That's right, yeah. Right. And so he's been actively involved in this for a long time. Him and Commissioner Carmen Rubio, who's in charge of that bureau, flew to Denmark in 2022 to, you know, kind of see this Denmark model of what they, you know, what they call like the industrial symbiosis model. And this is how we get back to, you know, how the city is going to move forward and who it includes, I think is sort of illustrates who has power. And there's always going to be this tension. I think the form of government is built to have some of that tension. You know, if the mayor is seen as sort of the governor and the city council is seen as sort of the legislature, that tension and where you can find common ground is really important. The question then becomes, though, what if the community is begging for something and has been actively begging for something for a long time? How do they how do they get a seat at the table for something that the executive branch, then the mayor and the city administrators, argue is simply an administrative decision that the city council has no power over.
You know, these arguments kind of feel like what's going on the federal level, only in reverse. But it feels, well, and maybe not so much in reverse, because it feels like what the city did with the Zenith Lux application was to say, when it was very clear that in fact, DEQ was saying they need to be held publicly accountable, that they said, no, it's just an administrative decision. It's no different than giving a Lux to a daycare center.
Right.
And a lot of people going, what? This is, like, really short-sighted. Some of the correspondence that you were able to unearth between Zenith and people particularly with the Portland Business Alliance and Donnie Oliveira, I think maybe shed a different light on what these relationships are and how far they are from what the idea of a new city charter envisions.
Yeah. It was always going to be a question of where and who, like, whose ear the Metro Chamber could get. And that's not to say that there aren't lobbyists from the Portland Metro Chamber who are trying to get at city councilors probably all the time for these votes. But what we got through these records requests, I was really curious to kind of hear, like, see who was interacting around the Zenith stuff. More of the timeline, you know, I try to get a hold of specific things related to Zenith, and then just kind of did a little bit more broad of a search, and found that John Isaacs, one of the more prolific lobbyists from the Portland Metro Chamber, had messaged the deputy city administrator, Donnie Oliveira, on January 16th to say, can we get drinks next Wednesday or Thursday post-work? I feel urgency in this right now. Donnie Oliveira responded the next morning and said, you know, sounds good. I'd like to get briefed on the state of the economy report coming out too. So these two then met up the day, just to make sure I get my facts straight. The day after a Portland City Council work session on Zenith Energy. Where it starts to get a little bit funky is I can't tell you what they talked about when they went and had Sazeracs at Patty's Bar on the 16th.
But we do know they had Sazeracs.
22nd. We do know they got Sazeracs. I can't tell you exactly what they talked about there, but I can tell you that when I asked questions about what they talked about, they both got very dodgy. And to the point that, you know, in the initial message, John Isaacs had said, block February 8th for nerdy game night with Carmen and me. I assume that's Carmen Rubio. I asked, are you referring to Carmen Rubio? And he said, I'm not going to misquote anyone here, but he said, there were over a dozen individual friends of mine on the game night invite, so I wasn't referring to anyone in particular. So I'm not sure if he has 12 friends named Carmen.
Probably he does.
Probably. And they're all invited to game night. Or what was going on there. But I'm not totally sure if there's nothing, you know, untoward happening here, why you can't just say, yes, I was referring to Carmen Rubio. He also said Donnie Oliveira did not respond to that message or attend. But what Donnie Oliveira had said was, sounds good. I would like to get briefed on the state of the economy report coming out too. He told me, John Isaacs told me that he has spoken to Donnie Oliveira one time this year, and the records showed that there were 29 text messages back and forth. They sat at a Metro Regional Housing Stakeholder Advisory Table earlier that month together, sat at the same table. The phone call records show that there was a 10-minute phone call the morning, you know, before they met on the 22nd, the day after the Zenith City Council session. And so there's kind of a lot of things that just don't really quite align with the idea that they went there and did not talk about the exact thing that the Metro Chamber then sent a letter about to the City Council to try to get them to approve this land use statement.
Well, I also recall in your article that there was some very, very intense mention about the kind of friendship they had in these exchanges.
Yeah, And I think it's worth saying, you know, that they kind of both said to me, like, hey, friendships emerge, you know, professional friendships emerge. And so, yes, we went out and had drinks. And I do want to be, you know, very clear. I don't know if it comes through in the article or not, that people are welcome to be friends with each other. I think that professional relationships are totally fine. The issue that I think is presented here is that, you know, the city lobbying code says that even the appearance of impropriety in this way is an issue. And if people are going out immediately after a highly publicized issue that the community deeply cares about, and they're going out the day after to talk about things, you know, they said, we talked about the clean industry hub. It's like, well, if you're talking the day after the Zenith Energy work session about the clean industry hub, it's not about other stuff. It's about Zenith, because that's the specific thing that's happening at the CEI hub right now.
Well, I just want to talk a little bit about what happened at that meeting, which was the work session on Zenith, because that was an interesting meeting, too.
It was. I would say that that was a very important meeting. It seemed to be trying to address, maybe in a legal way, just for sort of legal cover, trying to say that they had done this quasi-judicial process that the State Land Use Board of Appeals, you know, had previously determined the Zenith land use statement should be. There were also a whole lot of omissions. You know, we started this show today talking, you know, stepping back to December 6th when DEQ fined Zenith $372,000 for illegally constructing its pipes and transloading, I think, 39 different times, you know, in those pipes over the course of 3 years. That never came up in the city's presentation about why Zenith was even back at the city in the first place. Those are things that I think city councilors were aware of, and you know, I'd be curious to hear from them if they noticed the omission of those details. It also just kind of really seemed to want to gear, you know, Donnie Olivera was giving this presentation and really wanted to gear this thing toward, like, this is an administrative process. If you wanted to do something else, you could, but it would kind of like take time, and we don't, you know, just sort of trying to push that off. And I think the main purpose of that was to provide some kind of cover to say, hey, this is our decision and the city council can't do anything about it.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And we're now in our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign. It's going on now through April. This month, KBOO is celebrating Women's History Month by bringing you a series of special programs throughout the month created by, for, and about women. Check out this special and more at kboo.fm/atnf4. And today we're talking with Street Roots investigative journalist Jeremiah Hayden about what he has uncovered through public documents requests that reveal the cozy relationship between members of the city's administrative branch and the Portland Metro Council. Now, one of the concerns of some of the city council members, particularly Mitch Green, who spearheaded this resolution that is hopefully going to be heard this Wednesday, was that the city lied, basically that the city staff lied about Zenith. That's, I think, being proposed. That best you could say is they left out major details. I know that I got to the hearing a little late. I was surprised that it was still going on, actually, when I got there. And at that point, when I got there, there were four people who were representing the community who were talking about why Zenith should not get the Lux. And then I heard about what the city had done. And first of all, the reason why the people who were giving this presentation were after there was supposed to be a break between this and the city council meeting in the afternoon was that the city staff had gone way over time, and I'm not sure, sounded like they'd obfuscated a lot, and basically ran into the time for the people who were opponents of Zenith so that they didn't have time to take questions. So to me, that shows a certain kind of contempt for the community right there.
Yeah, it was a bit of a longer presentation for sure, and it I think for community members, it is disappointing to see, you know, in a I believe it was a two-hour work session up front, and then there was a community feedback, like listening session for 2 hours later that afternoon. And the first half of that really was taken up by the city, and then also Zenith had an opportunity to speak, and they had took some questions and took quite a while as well. And yeah, there wasn't the same time allotted for community members to for the city council to ask questions of community members. And you know, this is all it all is very interesting to see what, like, who is considered a community member. And a lot of times, you know, these organizations like the Clean Industry Initiative, which is something that the Portland Metro Chamber is part of, it's this collaboration between public, private, nonprofit organizations closely related to this Clean Industry Hub, is essentially the same thing. This, you know, Denmark's, you know, industrial symbiosis model. The Clean Industry Community Program Grant, which is like through PSU and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, for this $20 million to help, you know, decarbonize the industry in Portland. All of these things include nonprofits, local environmental groups, you know, people that are on the boards of those nonprofits or whatever. But the outsized role there, the group that has the most outsized influence is always the Portland Metro Chamber. And they're the people who kind of have these relationships with industry as well. And so kind of trying to, you know, work these changes kind of slowly, very slowly, tends to push out, you know, community members who have maybe been working on this for a decade. It pushes out a lot of scientists, like real environmental advocates who are dedicating their time to this, and much more, gives much more influence to the city administrative branch, and then the fossil fuel companies who are promising to do these transitions, who have been lying about climate change for the last 50 years. Like, everything that they've ever done has been to protect their own business as a fossil fuel company. And so the sort of the idea that Zenith is going to come in here and change its practices, you know, is a little bit funny to begin with. And it seems like something that would cause the city a bit of concern. And the city might say, hey, we're not really interested in your false solutions. We're actually going to listen to community members who can, you know, see these tanks from their backyard.
Well, I'm going to talk a little bit about this this Copenhagen model that actually not just the city people went to visit Denmark, but also some of our state reps did, including Mark Gambo, who portrays himself as a climate champion. But I had a conversation with him last year about his trip to Denmark and how great he saw it being. And he said, what they do is they put all their garbage to use. So they, you know, this business creates garbage, and then this business turns that garbage into fuel or something like that. And I was kind of questionable about it. And one of the things that came up was I was talking to a climate activist about the conversation a while later, and it was like, well, shouldn't we be encouraging industries to produce less garbage and possibly no garbage at some point? So there seems to be, that's one of the fallacies in the model. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what that is and compare that with what I've heard described as a circular economy, where in fact you do work towards having no garbage.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of this, you know, this comes back to, I talked to Mary Pevedo from Neighbors for Clean Air about, you know, sort of related to garbage here is like old engines in cars and trucks and things like that. And how, you know, you might take a cleaner fuel and put it through a truck from the 1980s. And it doesn't really do all that much to actually reduce the carbon emissions. Oregon has really lagged, you know, from like California on updating its fleet, you know, and has instead sort of bought at a lower rate a bunch of really old trucks from California. And so this kind of idea that you could just like keep using the same old machines to address your climate crisis and then just get fossil fuel companies to chase their profits and do kind of some false solutions, and that's actually going to do something to reduce carbon emissions is a little bit funny. It's worth noting that the Denmark's industrial symbiosis model, to my understanding, is not the main thing that, you know, renewable fuels are not the main thing that makes that system work.
Are they using renewable fuels in that system?
I believe they are, but I think far more of their economy, they have electrified all kinds of things. They're, you know, providing much more efficient sources of energy in, you know, people's homes, things like that. And I think that's where a much larger influence on, you know, how much they're actually emitting there. But I think the thing that people, lawmakers, get tours on is the thing that's kind of easier. It's just to say, sure, keep building fossil fuel pipelines and we'll just do it with renewable diesel instead. And that's the concern that a lot of advocates have, is that when, you know, what if you can't produce enough feedstocks, you know, to actually support an entire industry of renewable fuels for airlines and all these things? That's food, you know, that people need to eat.
One of the things that the fossil fuel industry has been promoting when they promote so-called renewable diesel is that it's going to be produced with waste oil. And when I did these interviews in my documentary, this woman, Anna Alexander in California, said there's not nearly enough leftover oil from that. It's not nearly enough French fries in the world to produce the amount of renewable diesel that this one company, Phillips 66, on the San Francisco Bay, which is converting from fossil diesel to renewable diesel, how much they would use. She said that if, in fact, well, when I talked to her, their license was still being litigated, but now they are back in business, and as far as I know, they probably have finished the conversion. And she said that their needs would take 40% of all the soybeans grown in the United States.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you bring up a very good and really important point. And most of these contracts, including Zenith's promise to transition to 100% renewable diesel by October 3rd, 2027, these contracts have carve-outs in them so that if the renewable diesel is not available, then they can use fossil fuels. And so putting that in context with the Trump administration that has been just slashing everything that is climate friendly, you can imagine that right here on the Willamette River, right next to Forest Park, which brings up a whole other thing with PG&E.
I'm moving another story.
yeah, we'll get to that, you know, soon enough. But, you know, right there on Forest Park, they're building, expanding infrastructure. You know, one of the records we uncovered is that is Zenith's entire plan to really expand its operations and become, you know, the export hub for the entire West Coast. You can imagine that they would expand for renewables because they can get the permits that way. And then when the Trump administration says nobody can do any renewable diesel in America anymore, and the Supreme Court says it's fine to say you can't do that, then what do we have? We have a bunch of fossil fuels going back through the neighborhoods on expanded infrastructure. And Zenith, regardless of what happens in the future, Zenith has forever, since it promised to have no new fossil fuel throughput emissions in 2019, has only increased its throughput every single year since.
Well, I have some concerns, actually, that the Trump administration may not choose to stop fossil fuel, to stop renewable diesel production, because, in fact, his friends in the fossil fuel industry, this is their new veneer, basically.
True.
And so I feel like we need to spend more energy actually debunking fossil fuel, debunking renewable diesel as an actual renewable substance. And I'm remembering the clean coal campaign that went on about 20 years ago. And
right.
Sierra Club had this fantastic series of ads that were on TV. Here's clean coal, and you walk in this wall out in the desert, and you open the door to this building, and there's nothing behind it. And I think that really helped in a lot of ways to debunk the whole myth of clean coal. So it's something that we need to be doing now about so-called renewable fuels.
Right. And it's the paradigm, you're right. It's the paradigm of burning stuff that's the problem. Like, if we're burning things, then those things are being burned into the atmosphere. And that's what's causing climate change. So you're right that does continue that paradigm. It really is kind of dangerous to buy into those you know, false solutions.
So we've been throwing around the word false solutions a lot, but I'm wondering how And in your writing in particular, since I think you're such a good writer and you have been writing these very compelling articles in Street Roots, how do we get listeners and readers and the general public to understand what this whole concept of fault solutions means?
That's the work every day, isn't it?
How do we do the equivalent of those wonderful Sierra Club ads?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that providing context is really important, and you can have a story that is, here's what the news is, and that is really important for people to know kind of what the latest update is on something that they've been following for some time. We have examples of this stuff in the past. I think of, you know, smoking, you know, tobacco campaigns, and we have, the asbestos, you know, is another one of them.
And actually, CFCs, the Montreal protocols, which got rid of aerosol propellants.
Oh, right.
And totally redesigned the whole aerosol industry.
Right. So, you know, yeah, exactly. So you know how these things work, and somehow trying to help, you know, myself included, you know, but help, you know, I learn a lot every time I write one of these articles, and then try to, like, you know, in the public interest, just kind of tell people what we've found. Like, it is really important to set up not just like what's happening, but how it's happening. And I think that's always kind of a way to look, you know, through a critical lens at what, if we're being told something by a fossil fuel company, it's probably not because it's in our best interest. It's just not what they do. You know, tobacco companies, the same thing. They're not, oh, you can vape now. Okay. It's different. You know, it's not that different. So I don't totally know, but I do think it's important to highlight the impacts that the newer idea of these quote unquote cleaner fuels, you know, sort of debunk, you know, show what's really happening there. What does it really mean that they're maybe cutting down, you know, maybe it's palm oil coming from, you know, from
Indonesia.
From Indonesia. Like, there are a lot of ways that these companies continue to do this stuff because they want to keep burning stuff, because every time it burns, they see dollar signs and they're totally fine with that.
And you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFD, LPFM, KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. And we're in our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign that goes on now through April. This month, KBOO is celebrating Women's History Month by bringing you a series of special programs throughout the month created by, for, and about women. And check out the special and more on kboo.fm/ATNF4. And I found the information I was trying to remember about this coming up, this Rumble on the River coming up this Thursday. So just let you know that it's called Renewable Fuels, Climate Fix, or Magical Thinking. It's this Thursday, March 20th. Doors and info tables start at 5:30. The panel begins at 6:30. It's at Havara Shalom, which is 825 Northwest 18th Avenue in Northwest Portland. And just to give you a sense of what it's about, just as it seems that we were making real climate progress, the fossil fuel industry sidetracking elected officials, regulators, and business leaders with a rash of climate solution diversions. In the face of Zenith Energy's plans to make Portland the West Coast center for so-called renewable diesel and sustainable aviation fuel, the panel will examine how renewable diesel is fraught with all kinds of problems and dangers and actually may have a higher carbon footprint than petroleum-based fuels, and how renewable natural gas actually comes from methane produced by tortured animals and factory farms. And the panel includes Amy Van Saan, who's a senior attorney with Center for Food Safety and serves with Stand Up to Factory Farms. And she'll be talking about the so-called biogas, which is really factory farm gas. And also Jeremiah, who's here, will be talking about what we're talking about today. Dan Sears, who's advocacy director with Columbia Riverkeeper, will be talking about NextEnergy's plans to build one of the world's largest renewable diesel refineries in Port Westward on the Columbia Estuary. And then I'll be showing the first 15 minutes or so of my new film, Chasing Chimeras, which looks at the fallacy of renewable fuels and what it's all about. So anyway, we're talking today with Street Roots investigative journalist Jeremiah Hayden about what he's uncovered through public document requests that reveal the cozy relationship between members of the city's administrative branch and the Portland Metro Council. I want to get back now to that guy, Donnie Olivero, that we were talking about a half hour ago. I understand that when he was asked, I mean, because the people on the city council were basically saying, a number of them were saying, we should not make a decision about the Lux until after we have the meeting that they're going to have this Thursday, this Wednesday, and that the February 4th deadline is not a deadline for the city, it's a deadline for Zenith, and they can always ask for an extension from DEQ. But Donnie, when he was asked about that, would say, well, we think it's an administrative decision, and we'll see how it goes. But I had the feeling pretty much early on that he already had this agenda, and he sort of knew that it was sealed. And I'm wondering if you've got any sense from the documents that you've uncovered why Donnie Olivares moves with the kind of confidence he does, that he's still in control of things.
Well, he seems to still be in control of things. So I think that probably...
So why is he still in control of things?
Yeah. Well, it is a question. I mean, I think that, you know, this kind of comes back to a matter, you know, sort of looking at this, you know, sort of bird's eye view. It appears to come down to a matter of will. If the city wanted to say, no, we cannot, we're not, this is not compatible, or no, we're not going to allow you to... get your new permit from DEQ because you've lied to us over and over again over the last decade, or give any sort of consequence for Zenith's actions in town since they got here. The city could do that. The city recently got sued by environmental groups, appealed this land use decision to the Land Use Board of Appeals, and can outline, I think, for the city attorney exactly how they might decline to give Zenith this land use statement. So I did ask Mayor Wilson when I interviewed him in December about Zenith, and he said, look, 90% of the fuels in Oregon come from Portland. They come from the CEI hub. What are we supposed to do? And that is not exactly, you know, this is the same mayor who asked the city to wait on this land use decision, saying it would be unfair to community groups. And, you know, that seems like a big win. But in the end, you know, his truck fleet, you know, has partly transitioned to electric vehicles and also uses a lot of renewable diesel.
I understand he's only had a couple electric trucks and a lot of renewable diesel trucks.
Yes, right. And
that seems like a conflict of interest.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what kind of the details of that are. Maybe that's something that is also worth exploring a little bit. But the point being that if there is this sort of dominant, sort of common sense that renewable diesel is the answer. I think this comes from, I have asked Governor Kotek about this, and she's generally avoids the topic altogether and just kind of says like, well, I don't totally understand this, you know, piece of it or whatever. But in the end, this is still being pushed through. And you can see, if you look at this map, and I'll show this map on Thursday at the Rumble on the River event. If you see this map, you can see that there are probably a whole bunch of players in this thing who want to see Zenith or whoever be able to bring through these fuels, bring through sustainable aviation fuel to the airport, and then say, look, the West Coast is a green economy. And let that be more of a branding thing than it is like actually addressing, you know, these really, really catastrophic, you know, issues with climate change.
Well, at the Public Interest Environmental Law Conference a couple of weeks ago, I went to a workshop about, well, it was about a bunch of things, a lot about the endangerment to indigenous communities from all the rare earth and other valuable minerals mining is going on, and a real wake-up call to look at what in the so-called renewable economy that we're doing that's really devastating to particularly indigenous people. Just like uranium mining basically hit indigenous land for the last 80 years, and same is true with lithium. But I learned this interesting fact that if you were to recycle cell phones, smartphones, and you took the lithium out, which maybe it's easier to do now. That's partly there have been laws that have changed so that phones now need to be recyclable and they need to be able to get the lithium extracted. And I don't remember the number, but it was an awful lot of solar panels or an awful lot of actually, it was an awful lot of lithium-ion batteries. I mean, probably enough to power the city of Portland. So there's a lot of stuff to be recycled in this really omnipresent, omnipotent thing that we all carry around in our hands now. So that, to me, is that's a circular economy as opposed to this industrial symbiosis. And that's what I'd like to have these people looking at, as opposed to finding ways to just satisfy the needs and the ravenous hunger of the fossil fuel industry.
Yes, and I think you nailed it there. This is all just a product of colonialism and capitalism, just through buried pipes all across the world, and where we used to be, where humans used to be a result of water, exist because of water. It's now just everything exists because of fossil fuels, and so you're either kind of stretch it a little bit for fun. Like, it's kind of, you're just like operating on the side of the colonial powers that are just okay with results like the Niger Delta or something, where people are just, it's just creating, all kinds of war like conditions and just living in all of this devastation because of, what Shell and Exxon and all these people do there. And you kind of either kind of continue that and ignore the negative impacts that it has on low-income communities, Black and brown communities, always the same people, the global South, right? And you can either operate in a way that says, oh, these same people who created that thing can fix it, or you operate from the position of the people who are living in tents, below all of the skyscrapers, not just in India, but right here in the United States.
Well, right now you're missing a very important city council meeting, right? I appreciate you're here instead of being in city council chambers typing away on your
computer.
You can't
write all the stories, so.
Right. So in just a moment or so, can you just synopsize what is going on right now and what hopefully will happen on Wednesday at City Council?
And so essentially, Streetroot's reporting is actually a couple of the exhibits in this. So if anybody's looking up the resolution, you can click through those exhibits and find the reporting that may.
Congratulations on that. I was very happy to see that.
Yeah. I think it is really it's always fun to see, your work as a journalist have some kind of impact. This is happening on Wednesday. It's one of the 6 p.m. Yet another great thing that came out of the new form of government is that they introduced evening meetings where the community can actually be much more involved if they work 9 to 5. But yeah, basically where we're at right now is at this very moment, the city is talking about the critical energy infrastructure hub right there where Zenith operates and, a dozen other fossil fuel companies and other companies. And then on Wednesday, this resolution, which is, I believe, expected to pass, hopefully, wants to declare basically the actions that were concerning Zenith over the last few months. They want to put the communications into the public record and then demand that the mayor investigates Zenith's violations of its franchise agreement. It also wants to urge the auditor to conduct an investigation into some of these kind of shaky statements that city officials have made. So there's kind of a lot in there, but essentially the city council is trying to find a way to hold the administrative branch accountable for the decisions that it makes that willfully ignore and sometimes operate directly in contrast to what the community is asking for. And I think this is one of the first examples of the city council being able to sort of assert that power, and we'll see what happens.
Well, stay tuned. Well, Jeremiah, it's great having you on Locus Focus. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks so much for having me again, Barbara.
We've been talking with Streetroot's investigative journalist Jeremiah Hayden, and you're listening to Locus Focus on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM, KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCB in Astoria, Oregon, KCEI in Taos, New Mexico, Radio Free Moscow in Idaho, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO public affairs programming, go to kboo.fm. Chatter FM or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. And I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff and volunteers who continue to do an incredible job of making KBOO the important community resource that it is. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member during our All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 special programming campaign going on now through April. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. This month we're celebrating Women's History Month with women-oriented content for hours. Check out our special programming at kboo.fm/atnf4, or please support the community station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll talk with Mike Houck about the need for Portland to adopt a climate adaptation policy. We'll go out with music by Francis Beebe. My engineer's Ray Bodwell. Thanks, Ray, and thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO.